From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Rock critic Robert Christgau has just completed a consumer guide to the records of the past decade. On today's Fresh Air, Christgau plays some of his favorites for us. In the 1950s, the movie business was in a slump, overshadowed by the birth of television. But that didn't stop American International Pictures. The company was successful because it brought teenagers into theaters with movies like I Was a Teenage Werewolf, Bucket of Blood, and The Puppet People. Coming up, we meet the company's co-founder, Sam Arkoff. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us about Smile, maybe the best album the Beach Boys never made. And book critic John Leonard reviews Cuba, A Journey by journalist Jacobo Timmerman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush met this morning with bipartisan congressional leaders to discuss the crisis in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The meeting came amid a step-up in the administration's rhetoric against Saddam Hussein and the president's remarks that he already has ample authority to act militarily without congressional approval. Today, several lawmakers said they advised the president to allow for more time for the economic sanctions to take effect. Senator Patrick Leahy is a Vermont Democrat.
Nobody asked the president to rule out a military option, but many of us told him to make sure that we don't use a military option out of the impatience, that we try the embargo, the sanctions, the United Nations resolutions, our allies' efforts first and foremost.
The lawmakers did not report on the president's remarks this morning. However, one congressman called the session a very lively exchange. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Religious violence took at least 21 more lives today in India as Hindu militants tried to attack a Muslim mosque they want to replace with a temple. The fighting took place in the northern Indian town of Ayodhya at a site holy to both Hindus and Muslims. A Hindu revivalist party has called on thousands of militants to tear down the mosque that stands on the site now and rebuild a temple they say stood there long ago. Some of the killings occurred when government police fired on the militants who were storming the mosque. There was renewed violence in the Israeli-occupied territories today. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
2 days after an order sealing off Palestinian residents of the occupied territories from Israel was lifted, violence has returned. In a Tel Aviv suburb, a Palestinian man was killed and two were wounded when the bomb they were planting went off prematurely, according to police. In the West Bank city of Nablus, a Palestinian stabbed and wounded an Israeli gasoline truck guard. The guard then shot and killed his attacker, and police declared the city a closed military zone. In Jerusalem, a police officer was slightly wounded by an Arab attacker who was quickly caught. The new violence comes a day after the government reimposed a ban on Palestinians who have in the past committed hostile acts from entering Israel. Now the government is likely to face pressure to once again seal off all 1.7 million residents of the territories from Israel. This is Brian Naylor in Jerusalem.
The toll of accidents and deaths of U.S. service personnel in the Persian Gulf rose sharply today. 10 sailors were scalded to death when a steam pipe burst in the boiler room of the Iwo Jima, an amphibious assault ship off the coast of Bahrain. A soldier was killed when his jeep plunged over an embankment in Saudi Arabia, and 3 others were wounded when a sentry accidentally fired his machine gun. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 18 points today to close at 2,448. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Robert Christgau has been called the Dean of Rock Critics. He's been writing about rock since 1967. For most of his career, he's written for the Village Voice. Every month in his Village Voice consumer guide, he reviews and grades new records. 3,000 of his reviews from the past decade are collected in his new book, Christgau's Record Guide, The 80s. Listening to many of the records over again and reevaluating his original grades, he thought about the directions rock music took over the past 10 years. We invited him to share some of his conclusions. Robert Christgau is considered a master of the short capsule review. Fellow critic Real Marcus says that the reviews sometimes read like tiny novels. I asked Robert Christgau what function he wants his reviews to serve.
Well, the function they've served in the past, it seems to me, is to sort of provide a guidepost by which a lot of other rock critics sort of test their own judgments. I mean, I think That may sound pompous, but I do think it's what's happened. And at the same time, and much more important to me, which is why I've now changed it since this book came out, it enables people who want to buy records to figure out what might be worth owning and fun to hear. And I know there's a lot of people out there who depend on my judgments.
Well, your new book gives a lot of your opinions on the music of the 1980s. And in the 1980s, you got very interested in world music. How did you start listening to it?
Well, I actually think it's more accurate to say that I'm interested in world music and a fan of African music. And I've been a fan of African music since I first heard African music, pop music, which was on John Storm Roberts' Africa Dances anthology. It came out in 73, though I didn't get one until 76, which is one of my favorite records of the 70s and in my essential discography at the end of this book. I love African music, sub-Saharan African music. The other kinds of world music, and there's lots of them, some of them I like, some of them I don't like. I don't like Bulgarian music very much, and whereas a lot of people do. And I'm not going to say that I'm right or wrong about that, but I do accept my own feelings. I tend to like the best of certain things. I really like Las Van Van Sango, which came out on Mango last year, but that doesn't make me a salsa fan. I've been hearing salsa for 30 years in New York, and I've never been a salsa fan, for better or worse.
Do you think that African pop music is compensating for something that's missing in rock?
Yeah, I do.
In terms
I
of
think
you're listening to it, yeah.
But both for me and for people in my generation, people by which I really mean people over, say, 35, I think it offers a sense of wholeness that they miss in the pop music. I mean, there's a spiritual confidence in that music which is lacking in even the best American pop. And also, it's a music which is more rhythmically sophisticated, which is definitely the direction in which pop music has gone all the way since 1955, without being disorienting or harsh. It's at the same time, it's rather sweet and mellow.
Do you miss the dimension of being able to understand the lyrics?
I certainly do, except when I read the translations sometimes.
Right.
In which case, I'm just as glad I don't understand them sometimes. Although there's a recent book called Juju by Richard A. Waterman, which provides some Juju translations, which really are quite remarkable.
One of the things that you write about world music in your new book is you say some Worldbeat fans are chronic tourists who prefer their black folks exotic and out of sight. How much do you think that accounts for world music's popularity
I'm
now, to the extent that it is
to
popular?
Some extent. I mean, to me, what I want to understand is why people who like world music don't like rap.
Mm-hmm.
To me, rap is an equally exciting area. Obviously more troubling, right? And I think that's why people stay away from it, because it's troubling. But that doesn't mean it isn't artistically interesting. I don't think there's a more musically exciting pop record in the 80s than the Second Public Enemy album.
I guess
even though he says nice things about Louis Farrakhan, who I don't especially like. It's still a musically exciting record.
Well, I want to talk with you about rap music, but first I want to get to one of the records I think that you think is one of the best world music records of the 80s. This is a group called Franco and Rushero. Tell us something about them. They're from Zaire.
Franco and Rushero aren't a group. They're the two great kings of Zairean soukous. Franco died last year, so Rushero is left.
Uh-huh.
Franco was the great musical innovator. Rushero is more the matinee idol. They're both terrific singers. Franco's also a great guitar player. They hate each other. They love each other. They've done about four or five collaborations. Franco must have put out 200 albums in his life. And this is the only collaboration of theirs I've ever heard. This music is very hard to find. And the first time I heard it, I said, my word, that is gorgeous, and I've never stopped loving it.
Well, let's hear it. That's Franco and Rushero. Bob Crisco is my guest, and he's the chief music critic for the Village Voice, senior editor there, and he has a new book that's just been published called Christgau's Record Guide of the 80s. You say think of Franco and Rochereau as James Brown and Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. Maybe Tom Jones. I have mixed feelings about Rochereau. Cross between Sinatra and Tom Jones is what he really is. Tom Jones ain't so bad, you know.
Let's talk about rap music. You had said when we were talking about world music that you don't understand why people will enjoy world music, but they won't relate to rap. Or you do understand it. It's because they feel that rap is hostile.
They're threatened by it. Absolutely.
And what do you think the sense of threat
comes
from?
And it's too close to home, you know? That's the other thing. I mean, there is no worry that somebody from Zaire is going to take something that's yours, be it your job or whatever. There's plenty of worry about the kids who do rap. They want what's yours. And they say so.
Well, how do you
And if you buy the record, you're giving them some of it. Maybe that's part of the problem.
Well, how do you feel about the lyrics in the more controversial rap
songs? I think there's a very strong streak of sexism, and what to me is an even more disturbing streak of homophobia. It's smaller, but it's more disturbing because it's more unmediated and unmitigated, which I think is to be combated at every turn. But that's not to deny the tremendous vitality of the genre as a whole. It's just, you know, you can't say that it ain't there when it is. You know, there's a lot of sexist metal, too, and I think most metal is boring. That's not true of rap.
You know, sometimes I'll listen to something by a group like NWA, which is one of the more, you know, gangster-oriented groups in their image, and I'll really enjoy their music and then think, gee, am I really being a sucker here by enjoying a group that's, like really very sexist in their... And their imagery, you know what I mean?
I don't blame you for feeling that way at all. And I think for any woman who listens to rap, I presume it's an extremely conflict-ridden experience when it's something like N.W.A. anyway, not when it's Queen Latifah.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, not when it's Queen Latifah. Once again, that's not to say that the musical interest isn't there. It's not to say that the depth of the samples on It Takes a Nation of Millions, which, is, by the way, is not at all a sexist record by me, including even this anti-soap opera song in which they say bad things about women who watch soap operas. I mean, they've been taken to task for that. I think that's ridiculous. You can't hear that music without knowing, if you're musically sensitive and know something about the traditions they're coming out of, how radically original it is.
Well, you want to play Bring the Noise from the Public Enemy record.
Yeah, that was the record that turned me around. I mean, I put it on the headphone. It was on the Back to Zero soundtrack before it was on this album. And I said, oh, well, now they're doing what they said they were doing before.
Which is what?
A radical, jazz-oriented, hard, danceable, beat-wise rap instead of just rhetoric with annoying noise behind it, which is more what the first record is. I'm overstating. But it just wasn't as well realized as the second record, and that's the reason it didn't do as well. Second record really broke them because it's just an amazing piece of music, and the rap audience is smart enough to recognize that immediately.
Okay, this is Public Enemy. Bring the Noise.
Yo, Chuck, these dirty dribblers are still front on us. Show them that we can do this, because we always do this. Yeah, boy!
Bass, how low can you go? Death row? What a brother, no, once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal beast. Public Enemy number one, 5-4 said freeze, and I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun, but it's the wax that the Terminator X-bun. Now they got me in a cell, cause my records they sell, cause a brother like me said, well, Farrakhan's a prophet, and I think you wanna listen to what he can say to you. What you oughta do is follow for now, power the people say, make a miracle, keep up the lyrical, black is back, all in, we're gonna win, check it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Here we go again. Bring the noise!
That's Public Enemy, and my guest is Robert Christgau. He's the chief music critic for the Village Voice, senior editor there, and author of a new book called Christgau's Record Guide, The 80s. And this is basically a collection of capsule reviews that were originally written for his Village Voice consumer guide. Another stream of music that I'd like to talk with you about from the 80s is post-punk. What do you consider the attitude and the aesthetic of post-punk, and how does that relate to punk?
Well, it's a very guitar-oriented. I mean, in an era when the synthesizer really was the dominant musical force, especially toward the future force. The post-punk aesthetic was still two guitars, a bass, and drums. And then maybe there's something special would be added here, saxophone here, an organ there, etc. But it was that basic Beatles, Stones lineup. It was also defiantly unslick, very song-oriented. To me, the great exponents are X, Husker Du, Los Lobos in their own way, and The Replacements and The Blasters.
Most of these bands got started on independent labels. Some of them stayed there. What do you think the effect of the independence, the indies, have been on the rock business?
On the rock business, it's a farm system. But for those of us who love music, it's an enormous advantage. There's somewhere out there, there's an entrepreneur who's ready to make a couple of bucks off somebody who likes African music or reggae or Haitian music or whatever. The indie labels, the Amerindie labels, as I call them, which put out a lot of these post-punk garage bands, they're in the same category. They service a minority taste that's a fairly large one now, serviced as it is in turn by college radio. As boring as I find much of that music today, not all of it, but much of it, and as irritating as I find it, the ideology which is developed around it in college radio, I'm tremendously glad that it's still happening and have not the slightest doubt it's going to continue to produce good music. The slightest doubt.
What ideology are you talking about?
Well, I mean, it tends to be rather narrow in its view of what's good and what's bad. It tends to reject popular music, which I also think is of enormous interest. The fact that I like X and Husker Du doesn't mean I don't also like Bruce Springsteen and Madonna. I do. But I think most of X and Husker Du fans do not understand Bruce Springsteen and Madonna, and that doesn't speak well of them.
Why don't we play something by the band X? They're one of the bands you write about in your new record guide. What would you like to play and tell us what you think really sets them apart?
Well,
set them apart when they were still together.
Let's call In This House That I Call Home from A Wild Gift. One of the great things about X, of course, was that it was this band about an unhappy marriage between John and Xene, and those of us who are involved in any kind of marriage really enjoyed the dramatizations that occurred in the music, which also gave it, I mean, because Xene was singing, it also gave it more musical instrument. A woman's voice was very, she's a wonderful singer and a great writer, really gave that band a special dimension. And then there was, they also had... great junk guitar, even a great drummer. Billy Brombrick was a great drummer. They're a wonderful band. I'm sorry they're gone. They're not as good as solo acts. They should have stayed together.
Okay, well, this is the band X. My guest is Robert Criscaw. He's chief music critic for the Village Voice, a senior editor there, and author of the new book, Criscaw's Record Guide, The 80s. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Robert Crisco is my guest, and his new book, Crisco's Record Guide, The 80s, is a collection of reviews of records from the 80s. These reviews originally appeared in the Village Voice in his Consumer Guide column. Bob, you're about 48 years old. And
that's correct.
You're one of the rock critics who's been at it the longest, and also one of the rock critics who at this point is the oldest. And I'm wondering...
I think there's a lot of guys out there who are still older than me, but...
Are there?
Yeah.
Running about rock?
Yeah. But anyway, not that much older.
Are there parts of rock music that are very teen-oriented? You know, they're about the anger and frustration and confusion of being young that you find it hard to relate to now?
It depends on what it is. If it's metal, I've never found it easy to relate to. I didn't find it easy to relate to when I was a lot closer to 17 than I am now because I didn't like the pomposity of the musical assumptions, and I still don't. If it's garage bands, well, that's a somewhat simpler, I mean, which a lot of that, a lot of indie rock is about this very same thing. That's easier for me. Although I don't have the same intense interest in it that a 19-year-old might have, and I wouldn't expect to. It seems to me what I do is, as I pick out the young people who are best, who are finding themselves the best, you know? Michelle Schacht and LL Cool J and Paul Westerberg are all kids finding their identities as far as I'm concerned, and I like them all. They each do it in different ways.
You have a 5-year-old daughter now. Do you think as she grows up it's going to make you any more empathetic with Tipper Gore and other parents who want stickers or censorship to protect their children from explicit lyrics?
No. Next question.
No, well, tell me why.
Well, because I'm opposed to censorship. And if So Horny causes my child pain, I'll have to figure out what to do about it. And I won't like the fact that it's caused her pain, but it won't mean I think it should be censored. I know what I think about censorship.
Is it something you'd want to hear or want to make sure that she didn't hear until a certain age?
That's conceivable, yeah. I mean, that's a problem I'm going to have to deal with when it actually becomes an issue, and I'm going to have to deal with it in the concrete rather than the abstract. I'm going to have to see how it feels. I don't think it's inconceivable that I'd want to prevent her from hearing certain things. There are certainly things I don't play for her now.
Mm-hmm. You were born in 1942, which is before the start of rock and roll. When did you first hear rock and roll, and what first excited you about
it? Alan Freed, 1954, bless his heart. I was a New Yorker. Moondog Matinee, was that what it was called? The Moondog Show, whatever it was he called it. I listened to INS before he came to the show. I listened to Jack Lacey and listened to The Countdown in 1953, when it was the Cordettes and Patti Page. And when Alan Freed came on, I said, this new DJ is going to be on. He came on, changed my life. Bless his heart.
Now, what did it mean to you when Patti Page was on the radio? You know, when
she
was in
I liked pop music before there was rock and roll, you know. The first record I ever bought was Secret Love by Doris Day, which had a song called Deadwood Stage on the other side, which I could probably still sing, though please don't ask me. And I bought Shaboom by the Crew Cuts.
The Square Group before, who did
but
it.
But I didn't know that the Chords had done a version. You know, I only found that out in the 60s or 70s. But rock and roll was better, and I remember talking about it with my friends, about rock and roll. Boy, that rock and roll, it's really great, right?
How did you start writing about rock and roll?
I was at Esquire. They wanted me to write for them. The secular music column, as it was then called, was written by David Newman, who had just written something else called Bonnie and Clyde and had better things to do. I said, I'll take that slot if it's open. They said, yes. That's how it happened.
What was it like to develop a style that you thought was compatible with the music that you were talking about?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've been influenced by a lot of great journalists, Pauline Kael, A.J. Liebling, Dwight MacDonald, all people I read in the 60s passionately, all terrific writers have a certain kind of juice in their style, you know? It was dense, it was a little slangy, but at the same time it was very literate. I would describe all three of them as doing that. And to me, that seemed completely in keeping with what I liked about the music as it developed in the 60s. It seems to me basically what being involved in the rock and roll aesthetic has done for me is that it, by my standards, it's kept me loose. It's kept me willing to do things that aren't done. I use a lot of slang. I use a lot of vulgar language in my writing because the voice lets me, and it's the way I actually talk when I'm not on the radio. I try to make my style an extension of my own speech, but my own speech is very much influenced by the fact that I spend 14 hours a day listening to rock and roll songs. The rock lyricists are the people who really have a feel for language as it's spoken, much more than most print writers, even the very good ones and even the ones who try. All good rock lyricists are good with cliches,
yeah,
they're good with idioms, they're good with, you know, they have a real sense of this coming slang term, which, and some of those actually enter the language and are very important.
Robert Christgau is my guest, and he has a new book called Christgau's Record Guide, The 80s, and this is a collection of his reviews of records from the 1980s. I want to ask you to elaborate on something that you say in your new book, which really got to me. You estimated that it would take about 220 hours to get through listening to your A-list of records just once, right?
That's right.
And you say, and you're paraphrasing Simon Frith here, the British music critic, you say that the 80s turned leisure into responsibility. Well, that really got to me. Can I get you to elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, what Simon means by it is that leisure, what used to be one's escape from work is now the basis of the capitalist economy. Because I'm part of that process, right? I do that work. There's a sense in which this book serves that need of the economy. And that does not make me especially happy, and it involves me in various contradictions, the most troubling of which to me is that I do not have the time to enjoy the music that I know very well is good, and that I almost always do enjoy when I do find the time to put it on again. Riding around in the car today, I put on Nick Lowe's Party of One, an album which I gave an A to in March and had not listened to since May. And it really sounded great, and I'm very sorry I haven't listened to it since May.
Do you ever get tired of keeping up with what's new?
No, not for more than 36 hours. That's just, I think that's actually one of my gifts. I think it's, if I believed in God, I would say it was a God-given gift. I don't get tired of music.
Robert Christgau, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. I really enjoyed it, as always.
Robert Christgau's new book is called Christgau's Record Guide, The 80s. Well, this is one of those favorite records he was listening to recently from Nick Lowe's Party of One. This is All Men Are Liars.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's music by the Beach Boys. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward tells us what happened when the band, known for simple songs about surfing and fast cars, started to get more ambitious. Beach Blanket movies were one of the specialties of American International Pictures. The company also made juvenile delinquent movies, monster movies, and rock and roll films. Cheap movies that played drive-ins and were designed to appeal to teenagers. We'll talk with the co-founder of AIP, Sam Arkoff. He oversaw the production of 500 movies, including I Was a Teenage Werewolf and The Amazing Colossal Man. And book critic John Leonard reviews Jacobo Timmerman's new book about Cuba. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has told his top military commanders to be ready for the possibility of an attack by the U.S. and its allies within the next few days. The Iraqi news agency says the Iraqi president talked about preparations for urban fighting in occupied Kuwait during a meeting with his military command in Baghdad. Tim Llewellyn of the BBC has more.
The report implied that he stressed the need to face a push by the multinational force into Kuwait itself and to prepare the Iraqi forces for house-to-house fighting. The Iraqi news agency said the meeting was attended by all members of the joint command of the armed forces, including President Saddam Hussein himself as supreme commander, several generals, and three cabinet ministers. It is not usual for the Iraqis to give details of such meetings, and it indicates that either the Iraqi leader has some raw intelligence that leads him to believe there will be an attack, or that he's sending warning signals to the American and British leaderships, who have been using strong language in the past few days about the importance of not appeasing Iraq in its invasion of Kuwait.
Tim Llewellyn of the BBC. At the White House, President Bush met today with top congressional leaders who said that they advised him to go slow concerning military action in the Persian Gulf. According to the congressman, the president is losing patience at Iraq's refusal to pull out of Kuwait. A White House spokesman says, however, that a peaceful solution to the crisis is still hoped for, and it's too early to make a judgment to the contrary. 11 Americans in the military have died over the last 2 days in the Persian Gulf area, all as a result of accidents. NPR's Michael Richards reports.
The number of dead has been rising during the day as sailors injured during a steam blast on board the USS Iwo Jima succumbed to their injuries. The Pentagon says the Iwo Jima was in port in Manama, Bahrain for maintenance when a boiler pipe burst. Elsewhere, one Marine died and three others were injured when their vehicle overturned in the desert before sunrise. And three sailors were injured yesterday when a Marine Corps sentry opened fire on them when their vehicle approached a U.S. base. The Pentagon says the shooting was accidental, but pending an investigation, won't say how it might have happened. So far, more than 36 Americans have died as a result of mishaps related to Operation Desert Shield. Pentagon spokesman Bob Hall says that number isn't unusually high when so many members of the armed forces are involved in an operation all at once, even in the absence of hostilities. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
Iraq says it will not turn over a British Airways Boeing 747 until the airline sends back Iraqi Airways engines that it now has for maintenance. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 18 points to close at 2,448.02 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, some pre-Halloween horror. I'll be talking with the man who brought us I Was a Teenage Werewolf. Well, here's another teenage artifact. This tune, Let's Go Away for a While, was written by Beach Boy Brian Wilson in the mid-60s. Soon after, something happened to the wave of success that the Beach Boys were riding. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says it's hard to pin down any one reason for the commercial demise of the original group, but he's put together some of the pieces.
It was 1966, and the Beach Boys, of all the unlikely groups, had just done something nobody else had ever done. They'd produced an album of cohesive material, sumptuously and creatively arranged by Brian Wilson, that was not only a serious piece of music, but had 2 top 10 singles on it. It's a commonplace to say that Pet Sounds was ahead of its time, that if there'd been rock critics then, they'd have been raving about it. If the Beatles had made it, it would surely have been taken seriously. But the Beach Boys, sadly enough, were mere Californians, not exotic, not hip, with more fans in the working class than among intellectuals. It took a long time for Pet Sounds to make its impact felt, but by the end of the year, it was apparent that something was happening out in Brian Wilson's sandbox, that the British weren't the only ones who changed with the times, and that San Francisco wasn't the only happening place in California. In the fall, there was further proof.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Good Vibrations went straight to the top, and the rumors started. Brian Wilson, it was whispered, was working on nothing less than a symphony, a work that would be a summation of the Beach Boys' career and a new starting point, not only for them, but for American rock and roll. In fact, for some time, Brian had been piecing together a very ambitious work called Smile, and now he started to talk about it to some people, like the editor of America's first serious rock magazine, Paul Williams of Crawdaddy. Getting people to take the Beach Boys seriously wasn't going to be easy, but Brian would try. He worked hard, going over vocal parts until his fellow Beach Boys started to resent him. Then something terrible happened. Capitol Records and the band got into a dispute over royalties. There was talk of jumping ship, going to another label. There was the possibility the Capitol would refuse to release Smile to teach the upstarts a lesson. Brian stopped work on Smile to deal with the business problems and eventually destroyed it, erasing the tapes and giving up. Most people didn't know this, of course, but in the summer of Sgt. Pepper, it was weird indeed to hear what the Beach Boys released next.
I've been in this town so long and back in the city. I've been taken for lost and gone and unknown for a long, long time. Fell in love years ago with an innocent girl from the Spanish and Indian home, home of the heroes and
verbose, disconnected, and eccentric, Heroes and Villains was a piece of Smile that had survived. As a single, it did okay, but the version that was released was a pale shadow of the original. Then came the album, not Smile, but Smiley Smile. To anyone who'd caught on to the polished pyrotechnics of Pet Sounds, this was a slap in the face.
She belongs there.
Breathy, up-close vocals, spare arrangements, weird background noises. What was going on here? Who knows? Within what seemed like weeks, there was a new album. Honey did even less well than its predecessor, and it sounded like it had been made in a hurry, which it had. Even though the Beach Boys had come to a satisfactory agreement with Capitol, Capitol must have wondered if they'd ever see another nickel from the band. In fact, although the Beach Boys were still artistically viable, from a commercial standpoint, they were over. Although albums like Friends had a track or two which recalled past glories, the confidence that had kept the Beach Boys together as a solid creative unit was gone. And, despite a few more hit singles, the band had begun its inexorable journey to becoming the sad oldies unit it is today.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. American International Pictures got its start in the 1950s, producing the kind of movies teenagers loved and parents hated. They made juvenile delinquent films like Motorcycle Gang and Reform School Girl, rock and roll movies like Rock All Night and Shake, Rattle and Rock, horror movies like The She-Creature and Invasion of the Saucer Men, and movies where the monster was a teenager, like I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. By the late 60s, there were movies about LSD trips. In the 70s, AIP moved into black exploitation films. My guest Sam Arkoff co-founded AIP with Jim Nicholson in 1955 and stayed with the company until 1979. He oversaw more than 500 movies, almost all of them made fast and cheap. Dozens of now well-known actors and directors got their start at AIP, including the prolific director Roger Corman. The Film Forum in New York is showing a retrospective of some of AIP's films of the 50s, in a series called They Came from the Arkoff Archive.
Help me, doctor, please! I know they're going to catch me, but don't let anyone see me like that! Please, doctor, help me!
Michael Landon in a powerful performance as the boy possessed. Yvonne Lyon appealing as the girl who loves him. Whit Bissell, unforgettable as the scientist maddened by the mystery of the werewolf. And Tony Marshall, a tough, friendly enemy. Nothing you've ever seen has such blood-chilling savagery. Nothing you've ever conceived packs such a spine-tingling jolt. This high school boy, a teenage werewolf. A constant threat of claw-ripping attack to everyone, to the brave and the beautiful.
The coming attractions and the posters for the teen movies really promised sex and violence and thrills. Do you think that the pictures always delivered everything that they promised?
Of course not. Do you think that a perfume that's called opium or seduction or my sin delivers everything that it promises? I mean, advertising is advertising. It has a function. Now, if it goes too far, it becomes misleading. But on the other hand, I don't know anybody who advertises other than promisingly, put it that way.
As the executive producer of these movies, it was your job to make sure the things came in on budget, and the budgets were really very small. What was the penalty for a director who went over budget? What would you do?
Well, we never killed any.
Killed any directors or killed any movies?
No, we never killed any directors, although we thought about killing some, or at least severely wounding them. But basically what we did is we kept a strong hold on them. For example, we used to require directors pretty much to map out their camera movements ahead of time. In other words, to go in prepared as much as they could. And also we would have rehearsals of actors at times so that they would get to know their characters. This would all be done beforehand. In addition, if the shooting that went on, remember we made those early pictures now in 2 6-day weeks, if by the end of the first week we weren't really halfway through, we would get concerned and we would call a conference. I would come wheeling down in my black car to signify my villain's role And Jim would come over in his white car to signify his hero's role. And we would sit down with the director, off time, mind you, not on shooting time. And we had always kept the writers working on different projects, so we would have them there, and we'd say, look, we've got to make up this time, and to make sure we're going to, have you shot the ending yet? And if the ending hadn't been shot, we'd say, okay, we're going to shoot the ending in the next day or two to make sure we have it if we don't finish everything else. And then the director and the others would always look up and say, what do you mean if you can't get it in? I'd say, look, we have to end next Saturday. We're going to have to combine sets, for example. In other words, eliminate a set, put more dialogue on one set we were going to use. We're going to have to speed up. And they'd say, well, what if we don't quite finish? I'd say, well, we have the beginning and we have the ending. We just have to put some leader in between. And it's amazing how things caught up.
What kinds of contributions are you most proud of? What kinds of innovations are you most proud of that you contributed to AIP?
Well, I think we caused a lot of changes in the way things were done. We opened up in our pictures an area that really wasn't being exploited at all by the motion picture companies, and in a sense, we gave meaning to a good many youthful aspirations and problems and so on and so forth.
What are your favorite films of all the films that you produced?
Well, I've been asked that many times. It's more than 500 films. It's pretty hard really to grind down to a few. I can only say that the ones really that meant the most to me, basically, were when you had a successful picture of a new genre and it afforded you an opportunity to mine the vein for quite some time. For example, when we did the first beach party, it was successful. That was a great moment because we knew that we could do a certain number of sequels, in a sense, which turned out to be about 13 when we when we did the Edgar Allan Poe pictures. I think we did 13 of those also. We did a lot of motorcycle pictures. So whenever we would get into a new genre and it would work, it was a very happy moment for us.
But in terms of, like, personal gratification and actually enjoying the movie, are there any you like best?
Well, that's a good point. You know, I used to be a rather esoteric chap when I was going to the University of Iowa. I belonged to a group at that time, and there were quite a few New Yorkers among them in Iowa, and we only went to the one theater in Iowa City that played art films, foreign art films, one day a week. And unless the lovers sank to the sands as the cameras panned at the skies, I didn't think it was art. Now, my own personal proclivities, likings, and tendencies tend to be a great deal along that line even today. But there are a lot of the pictures that I do like, you know. If they're well made, I like them. A good many of the other pictures I like because they're good merchandise. You know, it just depends upon the factors. Anything, to say anything less would be dishonest.
What are you making today? I know you're back in film production.
Well, we're really making three pictures. We really have more. We have about 10 scripts, but we really are actively working on three. The first one is Ice Rider, which is about the next century, where to be different, in, you know, they're talking about the greenhouse effect.
Yeah.
Well, we say, and we have a certain amount of scientific statistics, that it will not really be a greenhouse effect, that it will backfire and turn out to be a new ice age. So we're based on that factor, we're making this, or we're going to make this Ice Rider. Secondly, we have in very advanced, really now getting into where we're considering the director and the stars, we're making a different version of Machine Gun Kelly, actually, this story in many ways is much more a love story than it was a gangster story, which it was the first time.
Yeah, Charles Bronson was in the original.
That was his first title role, yes.
And what's your third movie?
And the third one is also a sort of a remake, although it will be completely different. It's also X, the Man with the X-Ray Eyes, which we did with Ray Milland and Don Rickles back, I don't know, close to 25 years ago, I think.
Do you think that it's ironic that your movies are now being shown at museums as well as repertory movie houses? I mean, these are movies that you really made as merchandise to get people coming in. They were cheap films, and I mean, they've really endured over the years. And whether people watching them as camp or seriously or whatever, they're considered pretty important.
Well, I must admit that I'm surprised, since that was the furthest thing from our opinion when we made them. We were trying to make movies that would gross enough so that we can continue to make movies. And if our main concern had been to get them in the museums, God only knows what we would have made, because God only knows what we would have thought museums would take. Certainly, when we had our first major retrospective in after 25 years at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, I was one of the most surprised guys in the world, and I announced that, on the day of the opening of the retrospective. I suppose, in a sense, it's analogous to pop art. Somebody once asked me why I thought our picture should be in a museum, and I said, look, that was not my decision, but maybe the museum figured that we were at least as important as Andy Warhol's Campbell's Soups.
Well, Sam Arkoff, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Sam Arkoff, co-founder of American International Pictures. The AIP retrospective at the Film Forum in New York runs through November 15th. 40 AIP movies will be released on video next spring.
That's a bucket of blood.
Let us make the scene.
Crazy. Beatniks. Some brilliant, some bawdy, some brutal. That's a bucket of blood.
Now you're gonna shoot me! Don't shoot!
Horrifying as murder for art's sake. That's a bucket of blood. The picture that'll make you sick, sick, sick.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheim is with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Today on All Things Considered, we have more on the American attitude toward war. The President and the Secretary of State were sounding bellicose yesterday. We're asking today, are we on the road to war? Is Congress being consulted? Are they on the road to war? What is going on? We're also talking about politics, an abortion decision being considered by the Supreme Court, the politics of abortion and how the elections look generally, and a report on Lowell Weicker. He was a Republican senator. He's running for governor of Connecticut as an independent.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Former Argentinian newspaperman and political prisoner Jacobo Timmermann first came to international prominence with his book Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number. His other books include The Longest War, about the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and Chile, A Death in the South. Now Timmermann has a new book, Cuba, A Journey. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
Jacobo Timmermann is a troublemaker and a hero of mine, a kind of 20th century ancient mariner who keeps hitting us over the head, but each new time with a different albatross. In Argentina, because he was loud and Jewish and insisted on publishing the names of the disappeared in his Buenos Aires newspaper, he was kidnapped and tortured, and wrote a book about it, in which he just happened to mention the acquiescence in that torture by Argentina's silent Jewish community. Stripped of his citizenship, he arrived by bloody parcel post in Israel, just in time for the invasion of Lebanon, to which he objected on moral grounds in another book, and was reviled, even by friends on the Peace Now left, for daring to criticize Israel after living there only a year, for lacking personal experience of the Holocaust, for having been tortured, as it were, in the wrong language. Unrepentant, a couple of years later he went to Chile and wrote a book about that, deploring Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship, and and what Nixon and Kissinger had done to Latin America's oldest democracy. But he also attacked the left-wing pseudo-guerrillas and terrorists who grease the wheels of the killing machine. The man who had been tortured would not rationalize or excuse any form of terrorism. And now Timmerman, self-described as a socialist Zionist, has gone to Cuba and been appalled by Castro, whom he's known since 1959. He finds alienation and hypocrisy, megalomania at the highest levels, and informers on every city block. In the arts community, toadyism. Among journalists, censorship and despair. In Havana, you can't even buy those Soviet magazines that are full of news of glasnost and perestroika, neither of which has made it from Moscow to the Caribbean. We hear about re-education camps for homosexuals and the suicide of old revolutionary comrades like Heidi Santa Maria and Osvaldo Dordicos. There are bleak notes on domestic life, food shortages, sexual anxiety, and brainwashing in the schools. But as in Chile, so in Cuba, Timmerman spends much of his time thinking about and talking to writers. In prison or in exile are the likes of Carlos Franchi, Herberto Padilla, and Cabrero Infante. His villain here is Gabriel Garcia Marquez, a buddy of Castro's, and, quote, one of the greatest writers of our time, who did help Padilla get out of the country alive, but who's otherwise complicit in this left dictatorship, even disgusting in, quote, his public eulogies with their Byzantine hyperbole. The late Alejo Carpentier is likewise accused of obsequiousness towards the regime. His hermetic Baroque novels had to be read between their lines to find any hint of intellectual dissent. Why, Timmerman wonders, after 12 years of war in Angola and Ethiopia, hasn't there been a single Cuban novel or poem about it that's more than pamphleteering stupidity? Language consumes this ancient mariner, this bad news bear, this ferocious witness, because corruptions of language and corruptions of power are joined like monstrous Siamese twins. One journalist he talks to prefers to work as a fumigator instead of a reporter. Says Timmerman, he'd rather poison garden insects than Cuban mines. That's Timmerman, the fumigator, a conscience and an insecticide.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Cuba, A Journey, by Jacobo Timmerman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about vampires, witches, the church, and pornography with best-selling author Anne Rice. And writer Robert Peterson tells us about the early history of basketball. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.